The buzzer for the building door goes off 3 times, and Leon jumps up so quickly that I'm almost thrown off the bed. "Sorry," he calls over his shoulder as he heads to the door. I hear Mo or Gertie lift the receiver to let Richie up into the building. My stomach flips as I yank on the knitted jumper and run my fingers through my hair. I wait to hear Richie's voice at our front door, hanging back to give him and Leon the moment they've been waiting for. Instead, I hear Justin. "I want to talk to you," he says. "Oh, hello, Justin," Leon says. At this point, I notice that I'm already hugging my arms close to myself and tucking my body in against the wardrobe so nobody who leans in to check the flat will see me in the bedroom doorway, and I suddenly feel like screaming. He does not get to come here and do this to me. I want him gone, really gone, not just out of my life, but out of my head as well. I am done with cowering behind doors and feeling frightened. Well, I'm not, obviously, because you don't get over shit like this that quickly. But temporarily, I am done with it, and I'm going to make the most of this current wave of crazy, angry confidence. I round the corner. Justin is squared up in the doorway, broad, muscled, and visibly angry. "Justin," I say, moving to stand beside Leon until I'm only a few feet from Justin. I rest a hand on the door, ready to slam it closed. "I'm here to talk to Leon," Justin says shortly. He doesn't even look at me. I recoil despite myself, my confidence instantly drained. "If you're thinking of proposing to me too, the answer's no," Leon says pleasantly. Justin's hands bunch into fists at the joke. He starts forward, body coiled, eyes flashing. I flinch. "Watch that foot, Justin," says Gertie sharply from behind me. "If it gets any closer to being inside this flat, your lawyer will have a lot more to talk to me about." I watch the thought hit Justin, see him reevaluate. "I don't remember your friends being this interfering when we were together, Tiffy." He snarls the words and my heart thunders in my chest. I think he's drunk. That is not good. "Oh, we wanted to be," Mo says. I take a deep, shaky breath. "Leaving me was the best thing you ever did for me, Justin," I say, doing my best to stand as squarely as he is on the other side of the threshold. "We're done. That's it. Leave me alone." "We're not done," he says impatiently. "I'm getting a restraining order," I choke out before he can say anything else. "No, you're not," Justin scoffs. "Come on, Tiffy, stop being such a child." I slam the door in his face so hard everyone jumps, including me. "Fuck!" Justin yells from the other side of the door. And then there's the sound of a fist being rammed into the door and the handle rattles hard. I let out a little whimper despite myself, backing away. I can't believe I just slammed the door in Justin's face. "Police," Leon mouths at us. Gertie flicks on her phone and dials the number, reaching with her other hand to clasp my fingers tightly. Mo is at my side in moments, standing at my shoulder as I watch Leon slip the new chain across and lean his weight against the door. "This is so fucking crazy," I say weakly. "I can't believe this is happening." "Let me in," Justin roars from the other side of the door. "Police," Gertie says into the phone. Justin hammers with both fists on the door, and I think of how he pressed his finger against the buzzer all those weeks ago, how he wouldn't let up until Leon opened the door. I swallow. Each bang seems louder than the last, until I feel like they're right in my ears. My eyes are wet with tears. Gertie and Mo are all but holding me up. So much for being done with feeling frightened. As Justin roars and rages on the other side of the door, I watch Leon, face drawn and serious, as he looks around for other ways to barricade us in. To my left, Gertie answers questions on the phone. And then, suddenly, all the madness and noise stops. Leon gives us a questioning look, then checks the handle. The door is still locked. "Why has he stopped?" I ask, gripping Gertie's hand so tightly I can see my fingers going white. "He stopped banging on the door," Gertie says into the phone. I hear a tinny voice respond. "She says he may be trying to find a way to break down the door. We should move into another room. Step away from the door, Leon." "Wait," Leon whispers, leaning to listen to what's going on outside in the corridor. His face breaks into a grim smile. He gestures for us all to come closer. Tentative, with shaking knees, I let Mo lead me to the door. Gertie stays back, speaking quietly into her phone. "You'd love prison, Justin," says a warm voice on the other side of the door with an unmistakable accent. "Really, loads of guys like you there."
"Richie,"
I whisper, "but he mustn't..." We've just got Richie out of prison. A fight with Justin will not end well for Richie, even if in the short term it means getting him out of the building. Good point, Leon says, eyes widening. He reaches to unlock the door, and I notice his hands are shaking slightly too. From the sounds of their voices, Richie seems close to the door, and Justin further away, towards the stairs, but still. I scrub my eyes fiercely. I don't want Justin to know what he does to me. I don't want to give him that power. Justin makes a rush for us as Leon swings the door open, but Richie pushes him nonchalantly, and Justin stumbles into the wall, swearing, as Richie steps inside and Leon pulls the door closed quickly behind him. It's over in a couple of seconds. I barely have time to process the look on Justin's face as he lunged towards me, desperate to force his way in through the door. What's happened to him? He was never like this, never violent. His anger was always tightly controlled. His punishments were clever and cruel. This is messy and desperate. Nice bloke, your ex, Richie says to me with a wink. Serious case of red mist going on out there. He's going to regret punching the door so much in the morning, I can tell you that. He chucks a spare set of keys down on the sideboard. That must have been how he got inside the building without buzzing. I blink a few times and take a proper look at him. No wonder Justin went quiet when Richie turned up in the corridor. He is enormous. 6'4" at least, and the kind of muscular that only happens when you've got nothing to do with your time except exercise. His black hair is buzzed short, and there are strings of tattoos down his forearms and one curling up his neck, peeking up under the collar of his court shirt, along with a cord necklace, which I bet matches Leon's one. He has the same thoughtful, deep brown eyes as Leon, too, though they're a little more mischievous looking. "The police will be here in 10 minutes, Gertie says calmly. "Hello, Richie. How are you?" "Devastated to discover you have a boyfriend," Richie says, clapping Mo on the shoulder with a grin. I could swear Mo sinks an inch or so deeper into the carpet. "I owe you a dinner out." "Oh, don't let me stop you," Mo says hastily. Richie hugs Leon so hard I can hear their bodies colliding. "Don't worry about that prick outside," he says to both of us as he pulls back. Through the door, Justin throws something. Whatever it is smashes against the wall and I wince bodily. I'm shaking all over. I have been since I first heard his voice, but Richie just gives me a friendly, unquestioning smile, and it's like an echo of Leon's lopsided grin. A warm smile, the sort that makes you instantly feel more comfortable. "Pleasure to meet you in the flesh, Tiffy," he says, "and thank you for looking after my brother." "I'm not sure this counts," I manage, pointing to the door as it shakes in the frame. Richie waves a hand. "Honestly, if he gets in here, he'll have to deal with me and Leon, and... sorry, ma'am, we've not been introduced." "Mo," Mo says, looking very much like the sort of man who sits in a chair and talks for a living and has suddenly stumbled upon a scenario where this might put him at a disadvantage. "And me and Tiffy," Gertie says sharply. "What is this, medieval times? I bet I'm better at punching people than Leon." "Let me the fuck in," Justin roars through the door. "He's drunk too," Richie says cheerfully, and then he lifts our armchair and shuffles us out of the way so he can dump it in front of the door. "There. No use hanging about in here now, is there? Lee, balcony still where it used to be?"
Yeah,
Leon begins, looking slightly shell-shocked. He's moved around to take Mo's place beside me, and I lean into his hand as he strokes my back, letting that sensation pull me together again. Every time Justin yells or thumps the door, I flinch, but now that Richie is here, weightlifting furniture, and Leon has his arm around me, the flinching is no longer accompanied by total blinding fear and panic, which is nice. Richie ushers us all out onto the balcony and shuts the glass door behind us. We barely fit. Gertie curls into Mo in one corner, and I fit myself in front of Leon in the other, leaving Richie most of the space, which is exactly what he needs. He breathes in and out deeply, beaming at the view from the balcony. "London," he says, spreading his arms out wide. "I've missed this. Look at it." Behind, back in the flat, the door thuds over and over again. Leon pulls me tightly against him, burying his face in my hair and breathing warm, calming breaths against my neck. "And we even get a great vantage point for when the police turn up," Richie tells us, turning to wink at me. "Didn't think I'd be seeing them again so soon, I have to say." "Sorry," I say, miserable. "Don't be," Richie says firmly in the same moment that Leon shakes his head into my hair, and Mo says, "Don't apologise, Tiffy." Even Gertie rolls her eyes in an affectionate sort of way. I look around at them all, huddled out on the balcony with me. It helps, only a little, but I don't think anything could help more than a little right now. I close my eyes and lean into Leon, concentrating on my breathing the way Lucy told me to, and try to imagine that the banging noise is just that, a noise and nothing more. It'll stop eventually. Breathing deeply, Leon's arms around me, I feel a new sort of certainty settle. Even Justin cannot last forever.
Chapter 74. The police take Justin away. He's basically foaming at the mouth. One look at him and you can see what's happened. A man who has always had control has lost it. But as Gertie points out, this will at least make the restraining order more straightforward. We inspect the door. He's dented the wood with kicking and chipped off chunks of paint with his fists. There's blood too. Tiffy turns her head aside as she sees it. I wonder what it can possibly feel like, seeing that, after everything she's been through, knowing that she loved this man and that he loved her, in his way. Thank God for Richie. The man radiates joy tonight. As Richie launches into yet another story about the lengths Bozo would go to for first dibs on the weights machine, I watch the colour come back into Tiffy's cheeks, her shoulders lift, her lips slide into a smile. Better. I'm relaxing too, with each sign of improvement. I couldn't bear to see her that way, jumping, crying, afraid. Even watching Justin carted away by a police officer wasn't enough to ease the rage. But now, 3 hours post-police drama, we're scattered around the living room just like I imagined it. If you squinted, you'd hardly even notice that the evening I've been looking forward to for the last year was briefly interrupted by an irate man attempting to break and enter. Tiffy and I have taken the beanbag. Gertie has pride of place on the sofa, leaning up against Mo. Richie is ruling the room from the armchair, which hasn't quite returned to its usual place since it was used to blockade the door, so now just sits somewhere between the hall and the living room. He says, I called it, just saying. Gertie replies, when though? Because I called it too. But I don't believe you could have called it right from the moment Leon told me he was getting someone in to sleep in his bed when he wasn't there. Not possible. Richie replies expansively, come on. You can't share a bed and not share anything else, if you know what I'm saying. And what about Kay? Richie waves a hand dismissively. Ugh, Kay. Tiffy interjects. Come on now. Oh, she was sweet enough. But she was never right for Leon. I ask Gertie and Mo. What did you think at the start? Tiffy interrupts. Oh, God. Don't ask them that. Gertie promptly. We thought it was a dreadful idea. Mo. Bear in mind, you could have been anyone. Gertie. You could have been a disgusting pervert, for instance. Richie roars with laughter and reaches for another beer. He's not had a drink in 11 months. I consider telling him that his tolerance will not be what it once was, and then contemplate how Richie will react to this suggestion, almost certainly drinking more to prove me wrong, and decide not to bother. Mo says, we even tried to give Tiffy money so she wouldn't do it. Gertie, which she said no to, obviously. Mo, and then it became clear that this was part of getting away from Justin, and we just had to let her do it her own way. Richie, and you didn't see it coming? Tiffy and Leon? Mo, no. To be honest, I don't think Tiffy would have been ready for a guy like Leon yet. Me, what sort of guy is that? Richie, fiendishly handsome. Me, gangly, big-eared. Tiffy, wryly, he means a non-psychotic guy. Mo, well, yes, it takes a long time to escape from relationships like that. Gertie, briskly, no Justin talk. Mo, sorry, I was just trying to say how well Tiffy did. How hard it must have been for her to break out of that before it became a pattern. Richie and I exchange glances. I think of Mam. Gertie rolls her eyes. Honestly, dating a counsellor is dreadful, by the way. This man has no concept of lightheartedness. And do you? This from Tiffy. Gertie pokes Tiffy with one foot in response. Tiffy grabbing the foot and pulling. Anyway, this is really what we want to hear about. You never did fill me in properly about you and Mo. How, when, excluding penis-related details, as discussed. Richie jumps in. Eh? I explain. Just go with it. It's best to let the in-jokes wash over you. Eventually they start to make some sort of sense. This from Tiffy. Just wait until you meet Rachel, queen of the inappropriate in-joke. Sounds like my kind of girl. Tiffy looks thoughtful at this, and I raise my eyebrows warningly at her. Bad idea to matchmake Richie. As much as I love my brother, he does tend to break hearts. I say, go on, Mo. Gertie? Mo to Gertie. You tell it. Tiffy interrupts again. No, no. Gertie's version will sound like something she's read out in court. Mo, give us a romantic version of events, please. Mo gives a sidelong look at Gertie to see how cross that's made her. Thankfully, she's three glasses of wine in and has just settled for glaring at Tiffy. Mo says, well, it started when we moved in together. Although Mo was in love with me for ages before that, apparently, says Gertie. Mo shoots her a mildly irritated look. And Gertie is like me for over a year, she said. In confidence! Tiffy makes an impatient noise in the back of her throat. And you're all loved up, sleeping in the same bed and all that. There's a shifty sort of silence. Mo looks at his feet, uncomfortable. Tiffy smiles up at Gertie, reaching to squeeze her hand. Richie jumps in. Well, looks like I need to find myself a flatmate, don't I?
September, 2 years later. Epilogue. There's a note on the door of the flat when I get home from work. This isn't unusual, per se, but as a rule, Leon and I try to confine our notes to inside of our home, you know, so as not to advertise our peculiarities to the neighbours. Warning. Imminent romantic gesture. Be assured it is very low budget. I snort with laughter and turn the key in the door. The flat looks the same as ever. Cluttered, multicoloured, and just like home. It's only when I go to chuck my bag down in the spot by the door that I see the next note on the wall there. Step 1. Dress for adventure. Please assemble outfit from wardrobe. I stare at the note bemused. This is eccentric, even by Leon standards. I shrug off my coat and scarf and leave them on the back of the sofa. It's a sofa bed these days, which only just fits in our living room, even once we sacrifice the telly, but no place will be home unless there's a bed for Richie to stay in. On the inside of the wardrobe door, the note is folded over and stuck with sellotape. On the outside, it reads, "Are you wearing something Tiffy-ish yet?" I mean, I am, but it's a work outfit, so there's more of a nod to normality than usual. I.e., I've tried to make sure at least two items are not direct opposites on a colour wheel. I rifle through the wardrobe looking for something suitably adventurous, whatever that means. I pause on the blue and white dress I bought a couple of years back, the one Leon calls my famous five dress. It's a little impractical for a cold day, but with my thick grey tights and the yellow mac from Help the Aged. Once dressed, I unstick the note from the wardrobe door and read the message inside. Hello again. Bet you look beautiful. You need to collect a few more things before you set off adventuring, if you don't mind. The first is in the spot where we first met. Don't worry, it's waterproof. I grin and head off to the bathroom, moving more quickly now. What exactly is Leon up to here? Where am I supposed to be going? Now I've got my adventuring dress on, the end-of-day work slump has lifted. Probably Leon knew I'd feel better with something colourful on, and a fizzing, giddy feeling is growing in my stomach. There's an envelope hanging from the showerhead, carefully and very thoroughly wrapped in cling film. On the outside of it is a post-it note. Don't read me yet, please. The next thing you need is in the spot where we first kissed. Well, not exact spot, as sofa has changed, but please overlook this for the sake of the romantic gesture. It's another envelope, tucked between the sofa cushions. This one reads, "Open me," so I do as I'm told. Inside, there is a train ticket from London to Brighton. I frown, completely flummoxed. Why Brighton? We've not been since before we were together, back when we were looking for Johnny White. The note behind the ticket reads, "The last thing you need is with Bobby for safekeeping. He's expecting you." Bobby is the man we once knew as Strange Man in Flat 5. He's a firm friend now and has thankfully realised you cannot make cider from a banana and moved on to more conventional apple cider. It is very tasty and invariably gives me an extremely bad hangover. I take the stairs two at a time and knock on the door, shifting impatiently from one foot to the other. He answers in his favourite tracksuit bottoms. I sewed the hole up for him last year. It was getting indecent. I patched it up with a few inches of pink gingham I had lying about, though, so he definitely doesn't look less strange. "Tiffany," he says, then shuffles off immediately, leaving me in the doorway. I crane my neck. Eventually, he re-emerges holding a small cardboard box with a post-it note stuck to it. "There you are," he says, and beams. "Off you go." "Thanks," I say, examining the box. "Once you get to Brighton, head to the beach by the pier. You'll know the spot when you see it." It's the most excruciating train journey I've ever taken. I'm itching with curiosity. I can hardly sit still. By the time I get to Brighton, it's dark, but it's easy to find my way to the seafront. I walk so fast towards the pier that I'm almost jogging, which is something I only do in extreme circumstances, so I really must be excited. I see what Leon means as soon as I get there. I couldn't miss the spot. There's an armchair on the pebbles 30 yards or so from the sea. It's covered in multicoloured blankets, and strewn around it amongst the rocks there are dozens of tea lights. I cover my mouth, my heart's thumping triple speed. As I make my way over, stumbling on the pebbles, I look around for Leon, but there's no sign of him. The whole beach is deserted. The note on the chair is weighed down with a large shell. Sit, wrap up warm, and open the envelope when you're ready. Then the box. I rip off the cling film and tear the envelope open as soon as I'm sitting down. To my surprise, it's in Gertie's handwriting. Dear Tiffy, Leon has enlisted me and Mo to help with this madcap scheme because he says you value our opinions. I suspect it is actually because he is a little afraid and doesn't want to do this on his own. I won't hold that against him, though. A bit of humility is good in a man. Tiffany, we have never seen you as happy as you are now. That came from you. You built that happiness for yourself. But there's no shame in saying that Leon helped. We love him, Tiffy. He is good for you in the way that only a very good man could be. It's your decision, of course, but he wanted you to know he has our blessing. Mo and Gertie, kiss. P.S. He asked me to say that he didn't ask your father's permission on account of that being a bit archaic and patriarchal, but he feels fairly confident Brian is on board. I laugh, shakily wiping the tears from my cheeks. My dad adores Leon. He's been calling him son in embarrassing social situations for at least a year. My hands tremble as I reach for the cardboard box. The sellotape takes an agonisingly long time to work loose, but when I manage to get the lid off, I start crying in earnest. There's a ring inside, nestled in a bundle of rainbow-coloured tissue paper. It's beautiful. Vintage, a little wonky, with an oval amber stone in its centre. And there's one last note. Tiffany Rose Moore, of Flat 3, Madeira House, Stockwell. Would you like to be my wife? Take some time to think about it. If you want to see me, I'm at the Bunny Hop Inn, room 6. I love you. Kiss. When I can, when my shoulders have stopped shaking from happy crying and I've wiped my tears and blown my nose, I head back up the beach to the warm light of the Bunny Hop Inn. He's waiting for me on the bed in room 6, sitting cross-legged, fidgeting. He's nervous. I take him at a flying leap. He lets out a happy sort of oof as I roll him back onto the bed. Yes? He asks after a moment, pushing back my hair so he can look at my face. Leon Toomey, I say. Only you could find a method of proposing that means you don't actually have to be there. I kiss him hard. Yes. Absolutely, definitely yes. Sure? He asks, pulling back to look at me properly. I'm sure. Really? Really, really. It's not too much. Bloody hell, Leon! I say, exasperated. I look around, reach for the hotel stationery on the bedside table, and write, Yes, I would love to marry you. Now it's written down, it is unequivocal and probably binding in a court of law. Although, check with Gertie, because I literally just made that up right now. Kiss, kiss. I wave the note under his nose so he gets the gist, then tuck it in the pocket of his shirt. He pulls me in and presses his lips to the crown of my head. I can feel he's doing one of those lopsided smiles, and it all seems too good, as if we can't possibly deserve it, as if we're taking too much happiness and not leaving enough for everyone else. This is the bit where we turn on the telly and a nuclear war has started, I say, twisting to lie down next to him. He smiles. I don't think so. Doesn't work that way. Sometimes the happy thing just happens. Look at you with all the sunny optimism. That's usually my jam, not yours. Not sure what's brought it on. Recent betrothal? Bright future? Love of life in arms? Hard to say. I chuckle, nuzzling into his chest, breathing him in. You smell like home, I tell him after a moment. You are home, he says simply. The bed, the flat. He pauses, the way he always does when he's looking for enough words for something big. It was never home until you were there, Tiffy. My name's Carrie Hope Fletcher, and you're probably sick of hearing my voice because you've just listened to me read half the book as Tiffy. But here I am with Beth O'Leary, who wrote the book, who wrote the lovely words that you have just listened to. And we're going to have a little chat.
Yeah, hi, I'm Beth O'Leary, author of The Flatshare. So just got here and heard a little bit of Carrie being an amazing Tiffy, which was just the weirdest and coolest experience.
It's the most terrifying thing because the only audiobooks I've ever done before are my own. So I'm like, yeah, I know what my voice sounds like and I can read, it's fine, I'm just reading my own words. But then all of a sudden when you're asked to do somebody else's audiobook, there's so much more pressure and you're like, it needs to be perfect.
I need to make sure
I sound okay. So The Flatshare tells the story of Tiffy and Leon, who share a flat, but more importantly a bed, but at different times of the day. So what inspired you to come up with that idea of a love story?
So yeah, the idea kind of came to me when I'd just moved in with my boyfriend, and he was a junior doctor just starting training, and he was doing lots of long stretches working nights. So I was commuting up to London, so I was sort of away for the whole day, and then I'd get home and he'd have just left. Like sometimes I'd even see him in the car going as I was like coming up from the train, and so there was always someone asleep in our bed. But just neither of us, we were never in there
never
at the same time.
Always passing ships.
Yeah, so, I kind of did start to notice things like, you know, like Tiffy does with Leon, like the cups by the sink and like, you know, whether his trainers are out, like has he had a chance to go for a run, and all of those things sort of got me thinking like how much you can find out about somebody when you're sharing the same space, but you're not together. So that was sort of where the idea came from. And I just thought, oh, is that like, could you fall in love that way?
Well, it is amazing when you're reading the book because you kind of don't realise that they haven't met yet. Because it does take them like half the book to actually meet. But you kind of fall yourself into thinking, oh, well, surely they've met because they've had all these conversations, but then you realise it's all just via post-it notes.
Yeah, it really kept me going, actually. I was really excited to write the scene when they meet. And I knew exactly how I wanted it to go right from the start. So I was sort of, whenever I got like, oh, is this working? I was like, just keep going. And then you get to write the bit where they meet.
That was my favourite scene to read.
It?
Yeah, because obviously I'm only reading half the book, essentially, because I'm only reading Tiffy's side of
that
it.
That must be a bit weird.
Yeah, but it means that I feel really lucky that I got the scene where they actually meet, because that was one of the chapters that I actually got to read.
And Leon gets the recovery scene, doesn't he?
Yeah, he gets the aftermath of what happened. But I just loved that scene where they meet. It's so brilliant and so funny.
Oh, thank you. I knew I wanted them to meet in the flat because it felt like everything sort of was circling around the flat, so they had to meet there. And then I was like, oh, are they just going to bump into each other in the hall? Like that's not very interesting. Well, where's it? And then I was like, the bathroom. There's a lot
it's
of like
so
comic
perfect.
Potential in the bathroom.
It's such a perfect meeting because of course like through the whole book they kind of want to meet, and there's even a point where sort of Tiffy's trying to construct the meeting, and it's just so great that it's just so unexpected and so out of their hands. I think it's just the perfect way for Tiffy and Leon to meet. It's so good. So how hard was it to write Tiffy and Leon while you were still working?
I wrote the book almost entirely on my commute. So I'd moved an hour out of London. So it meant I had an hour each way with my laptop and no excuse to do anything else because I was just sat there for that time. So it was actually really good. It worked really well for me having that those intense little windows of time to do it. And it was a little bit hard sometimes, especially at the end of the day, to switch off. But I bought myself some noise-cancelling headphones, which were like the best thing I ever bought. And I just flicked them on and I had music for that I sometimes listen to kind of get myself in the headspace. And then it never felt like, I guess because I was writing for fun as well, like it never felt like something that was sort of like too hard. But I guess it took a lot of time. But
yeah, I love a train journey for writing.
So it's productive,
just,
isn't it?
Yeah, because you've got nothing else to do, and so many trains don't have decent Wi-Fi.
Yes,
so you
perfect.
Kind of have no excuse but to just get on with something productive.
Yeah, it's so true.
You mentioned that you listen to music and you have sort of playlists to get into different headspaces for both Tiffy and Leon when you're writing their voices. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, so music was really, really useful. I think it sort of helped me get into not so much necessarily the individual characters, but just like the mood of the book. Like the playlist for The Flatshare is full of sort of folksy pop, upbeat stuff.
Right.
And once I was listening to it, I was kind of back there. And I used it a lot when I was editing as well, because I don't know if you find this, but sometimes when I've come away from the story and I'm being more analytical and trying to sort of chop it up, I kind of lose it a little bit. I feel like I've lost the magic and I've lost the sort of, you know, love for it. And
you lose
that
the feeling of what I was like to write it.
Totally, And having the songs that had inspired me as I was going along to kind of go back to would really helped with
sort of
getting
my... again.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Awesome. So I've said that my favourite scene to read was the scene where they meet in the bathroom. What was your favourite scene to write?
I would say that was definitely up there because it was just so much fun and I've been looking forward to it for so long. But I loved writing the epilogue. That was something that kind of, it came in later in the edits. So it was actually after I'd sold the book and had sort of feedback from editors, and they sort of said, oh, like the ending, I had a little short epilogue and it just wasn't, it didn't have like the kind of heart that I think it needed. And, and then we kind of came up with the idea for exactly how the epilogue would happen, and once I'd thought that, I was like, oh, I can't wait to write that. And it was just so lovely because I wanted to give the characters their happy ending, like you know, I felt so fond of them, and
I cried.
Oh, did you?
I cried. Yes. Yeah, I cried at the end of that book. I honestly was like, oh my god, it's the happy ending we all deserve. Oh my god. It was brilliant.
That's
it's
great.
So good.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm always really pleased when people tell me they cry, and then I sort of have the like after you're like initially like, yes, you're like, oh sorry. Normally not
sorry,
pleased
yeah.
when I make people cry, but I'm kind of glad this time.
Yeah, actually kind of thrilled. Yeah. Oh, well, thank you so much for asking me to be Tiffy.
Thank you so much for doing it. I mean, can I ask, like, what was it about the character that made you sort of interested in
she's
taking
just
her part?
She's so much fun. And I think she's got that sort of confidence that I wish I had, like, because the way she dresses and you know, she kind of has issues with past relationships and stuff, but I think in herself and the way, like, it kind of shows in the way that she dresses, she doesn't really care too much about what other people think. And of course she's, you know, described as a very tall girl, and it seems like she's sort of just grown up not being able to not care about what people think, because people are always going to look at her in some way or another and say stupid comments about her size and her height and stuff like that. I think also with the past relationships thing, I think people reading this book are going to really relate to Tiffy in some ways. I know I certainly did, because I've had my fair share of idiot boyfriends. I've had my fair share of Justins.
Oh God, I'm sorry.
No, but that's what's so brilliant about this book is that, you know, Tiffy isn't, you know, your typical sort of role model. I feel like so many people are sort of trying to, they're getting bogged down in writing the perfect female who replies to people and in the perfect way and does the perfect thing that everyone should take lessons from. But I feel like Tiffy's real. Tiffy actually reacts in the way that you would expect a normal human female to react in those situations. But eventually, through the help of her friends and through the help of Leon, she does eventually get out of that abusive sort of vicious circle. And I think girls who have been in the same situation are going to read that and take a lot of comfort away from Tiffy and the way that she does eventually get out of it.
Oh, I really hope so. I mean, I really wanted to write somebody that was going through something really shit, but was still, like, hadn't lost like the essence of herself, if you know what I mean. She was still like a very confident person and, you know, very unique and, you know, extrovert and kind of this sort of really lively person. And she was dealing with some stuff, and that had taken away a bit of her.
Yeah.
But she was getting it back, and I really wanted to kind of see her, you know, come through it. And I liked as well, I wanted to make sure that she was sort of going into like a really healthy new relationship. And so I wanted them to kind of be a friendship before they were a relationship.
Well, Leon's perfect for her, so
I'm glad you approve.
I highly approve, Well, thank you again for letting me voice Tiffy.
No, thank you so much.
And thank you for writing such an incredible book. It's so great.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Beth O'Leary. I really hope you enjoyed listening to The Flatshare. My next book, The Switch, is available for pre-order now in hardback, ebook, and audio. I can't wait for you to meet Eileen and Lena, my two new heroines. Continue listening to hear the first two chapters from The Switch, read by me. The Switch by Beth O'Leary. Chapter 1. Lena. I think we should swap, I tell Bea, bobbing up into a half squat so I can talk to her over my computer screen. I'm bricking it. You should do the start and I'll do the end, and that way by the time it gets to me I'll be less, you know. I wave my hands to convey my mental state. You'll be less jazz hands, B says, tilting her head to the side. Come on, please. Lena, my dear friend, my guiding light, my favourite pain in the arse. You are much better than I am at starting presentations, and we are not switching the order of things now, 10 minutes before our key client stakeholder update, just like we didn't switch at the last programme board, or the one before that, or the one before that, because that would be madness, and quite frankly, I haven't a bloody clue what's on the opening slides. I sag back into my chair. Right. Yes. I bob up again. Only this time I am really feeling... B says, not looking up from her screen. Absolutely. Worst ever. Shaking, sweating palms, the lot. Only as soon as you get in there, you'll be as charming and as brilliant as you always are, and nobody will notice a thing. But what if I... You won't. B, I really think... I know you do. But this time, only 8 minutes to go, Lena. Try that breathing thing. What breathing thing? B pauses. You know, breathing. Oh, just normal breathing. I thought you meant some kind of meditative technique. She snorts at that. There's a pause. You've coped with way worse than this hundreds of times over, Lena, she says. I wince, cupping my coffee mug between my palms. The fear sits in the hollow at the base of my ribs, so real it feels almost physical. A stone, a knot, something you could cut out with a knife. I know, I say. I know I have. You just need to get your mojo back, B tells me. And the only way to do that is to stay in the ring, okay? Come on. You are Lena Cossin, youngest senior consultant in the business, Cellmount Consulting's One to Watch 2020. And, she lowers her voice, soon, one day, co-director of our own business, yes? Yes. Only, I don't feel like that Lena Cotton. Bee's watching me now, her penciled brows drawn tight with concern. I close my eyes and try to will the fear away. And for a moment it works. I feel a flicker of the person I was a year and a half ago. The person who would have flown through a presentation like this without letting it touch her. You ready, Bee, Lena? The CEO's assistant calls as he makes his way across the UpGo office floor. I stand and my head lurches. A wave of nausea hits. I grab the edge of the desk. Shit, this is new. You okay? B whispers. I swallow and press my hands into the desk until my wrists start to ache. For a moment, I don't think I can do it. I just don't have it in me. God, I'm so tired. But then, at last, the grit kicks in. Absolutely, I say. Let's do this. Half an hour has passed. That's not an especially long time, really. You can't watch a whole episode of Buffy in that time, or bake a large potato. But you can totally destroy your career. I'd been so afraid this was coming. For over a year now, I've been fumbling my way through work, making absent-minded slip-ups and oversights, the sort of stuff I just don't do. It's like since Carla died, I've switched my writing hand, and suddenly I'm doing everything with my left, not my right. But I've been trying so hard and I've been pushing through and I really thought I was getting there. Evidently not. I honestly thought I was going to die in that meeting. I've had a panic attack once before when I was at university, but it wasn't as bad as this one. I have never felt so far out of my own control. It was like the fear got loose. It wasn't a tight knot anymore, it had tendrils, and they were tightening at my wrists and ankles and clawing at my throat. My heart was beating so fast, faster and faster, until it didn't feel like part of my body any longer. It felt like a vicious, thrashing little bird trapped against my ribcage. Getting one of the revenue numbers wrong would have been forgivable. But once that happened, the nausea came, and I got another wrong, and another, and then my breathing started coming too fast, and my brain was filled with, not fog, more like bright, bright light. Too bright to see anything by. So when B stepped in and said, allow me to, and then when someone else said, come on, this is laughable, and when the CEO of UpGo Finance said, I think we've seen enough here, don't you, I was already gone. Doubled over, gasping, quite sure I was about to die. You're okay, B's saying now, her hands gripping mine tightly. We're tucked away in one of the phone call booths in the corner of the UpGo offices. B led me here, still hyperventilating, sweating through my shirt. I've got you. You're okay. Each breath is coming in a jagged gasp. I just lost Cellmount the UpGo contract, didn't I? I manage. Rebecca's on a call with the CEO now. I'm sure it'll be fine. Come on, just breathe. Lena, someone calls. Lena, are you all right? I keep my eyes closed. Maybe, if I stay like this, that will not be the voice of my boss's assistant. Lena, it's Cece, Rebecca's assistant. How did she get here so fast? The UPGO offices are at least a 20-minute tube ride from Cellmount headquarters. Oh, Lena, what a mess, Cece says. She joins us in the booth and rubs my shoulder in nagging circles. You poor little thing. That's right, cry it out. I'm not crying, actually. I breathe out slowly and look at Cece, who is wearing a couture dress and a particularly gleeful smile, and remind myself for the 100th time how important it is to support other women in business. I really fully believe that. It's a code I live by, and it's how I plan to make it to the top. But women are still, you know, people, and some people are just awful. What can we do you for, Cece? Bea asks through gritted teeth. Rebecca sent me to check you're all right, she says. You know, after your... She waggles her fingers. Your little wobble. Her iPhone buzzes. Oh, there's an email from her now. Bea and I wait, shoulders tensed. Cece reads the email inhumanely slowly. Well, Bea says. Hmm? Says Cece. Rebecca, what did she say? Has she... Did I lose us the contracts, I manage? Cece tilts her head, eyes still on her phone. We wait. I can feel the tide of panic waiting too, ready to drag me back under. Rebecca's sorted it. Isn't she a marvel? They're retaining Cellmount on this project and have been very understanding considering, Cece says eventually, with a little smile. She wants to see you now, so you'd better hot-fit it over back to the office, don't you think? Where, I manage. Where does she want to meet me? Hmm? Oh, room 5C in HR. Of course. Where else would she go to fire me? Rebecca and I are sitting opposite each other. Judy from HR is beside her. I am not taking it as a good sign that Judy is on her side of the table, not mine. Rebecca pushes her hair back from her face and looks at me with pained sympathy, which can only be a very bad sign. This is Rebecca, queen of tough love, master of the mid-meeting put down. She once told me that expecting the impossible is the only real route to the best results. Basically, if she's being nice to me, that means she's given up. Lena, Rebecca begins, are you all right? Yes, of course, I'm absolutely fine, I say. Please, Rebecca, let me explain. What happened in that meeting was... I trail off because Rebecca is waving her hand and frowning. Look, Lena, I know you play the part very well and God knows I love you for it. She glances at Judy. I mean, Cellmount values your gritty, can-do attitude. But let's cut the crap. You look fucking terrible. Judy coughs quietly. That is, we wonder if you're a little run down, Rebecca says, without missing a beat. We've just checked your records. Do you know when you last took a holiday? Is that a trick question? Yes, yes it is, Lena. Because for the last year, you have not taken any annual leave. Rebecca glares at Judy. Something which, by the way, should not be possible. I told you, Judy hisses. I don't know how she slipped through the net. I know how I slipped through the net. Human resources talk the talk about making sure staff take their allotted annual leave, but all they actually do is send you an email twice a year telling you how many days you have left and saying something encouraging about wellness and our holistic approach and taking things offline to maximise your potential. Really, Rebecca, I'm absolutely fine. I'm very sorry that I disrupted the meeting this morning, but if you'll let me... More frowning and hand-waving. Lena, I'm sorry. I know it's been an impossibly tough time for you. This project is an incredibly high-stress one, and I've been feeling for a while that we didn't do right by you when we staffed you on it. I know I'm usually taking the piss when I say this sort of thing, but your well-being genuinely matters to me, all right? So I've talked to the partners and we're taking you off the UPGO project. I shiver all of a sudden, a ridiculous over-the-top shake, my body reminding me that I am still not in control. I open my mouth to speak, but Rebecca gets there first. And we've decided not to staff you on any projects for the next 2 months, she goes on. Treat it as a sabbatical. 2 months holiday. You are not allowed back in Cellmount headquarters until you are rested and relaxed and look less like somebody who spent a year in a war zone. Okay? That's not necessary, I say. Rebecca, please, give me a chance to prove that I... This is a fucking gift, Lena, Rebecca says with exasperation. Paid leave. 2 months. I don't want it. I want to work. Really? Because your face is saying you want to sleep. Do you think I don't know you've been working until 2 a.m. every day this week? I'm sorry, I know I should be able to keep regular working hours, that there have just been a few... I'm not criticising you for how you manage your workload. I'm asking when you ever bloody rest, woman. Judy lets out a little string of quiet coughs at that. Rebecca shoots her an irritated look. A week, I say desperately. I'll take a week off, get some rest, and then when I come back, I'll... 2 months off. That's it. This isn't a negotiation, Lena. You need this. Don't make me set HR on you to prove it. This is said with a dismissive head jerk in Judy's direction. Judy draws her chin in as though someone's clapped loudly in her face, perhaps, or flicked her on the forehead. I can feel my breathing speeding up again. Yes, I've been struggling a little, but I can't take 2 months off. I can't. Cellmount is all about reputation. If I step out of the game for 8 whole weeks after that UpGo meeting, I'll be a laughingstock. Nothing is going to change in 8 weeks, Rebecca tells me. Okay? We'll still be here when you get back, and you'll still be Lena Cotton, youngest senior, hardest worker, smartest cookie. Rebecca looks at me intently. We all need a break sometimes. Even you. I walk out of the meeting feeling sick. I thought they'd try to fire me. I had all these lines prepared about unfair dismissal. But a sabbatical? Well, B says, appearing so close in front of me I have to stumble to a stop. I was lurking, she explains. What did Rebecca say?
She said I have to go on holiday.
B blinks at me for a moment. Let's take an early lunch. As we dodge tourists and businessmen on our way down Commercial Street, my phone rings in my hand. I look at the screen and falter, almost running into a man with an e-cig hanging out of his mouth like a pipe. B glances at the phone screen over my shoulder. You don't have to answer right now. You can let it ring out. My finger hovers over the green icon on the screen. I bash shoulders with a passing man in a suit. He tuts as I go buffeting across the pavement, and B has to steady me. What would you tell me to do if I was in this position right now? B tries. I answer the call. B sighs and pulls open the door to Watson's Cafe, our usual haunt for the rare special occasions when we leave the Cellmount offices for a meal. Hi, Mum, I say. Lena, hi! I wince. She's all breezy and faux casual, like she's practiced the greeting before making the call. I want to talk to you about hypnotherapy, she says. I sit down opposite B. What? Hypnotherapy, Mum repeats, with slightly less confidence this time. Have you heard of it? There's somebody who does it over in Leeds, and I thought it'd be really good for us, Lena, and I thought perhaps we could go together next time you're up visiting. It's not hypnotising people like Derren Brown does or anything, it's... I don't need hypnotherapy, Mum. It comes out sharply. I can hear her smarting in the silence that follows. I close my eyes, steadying my breathing again. You're welcome to try it, but I'm fine. I just think maybe it'd be good for us to do something together, not necessarily therapy, but... I notice she's dropped the hypno. I smooth back my hair, the familiar stiff stickiness of hairspray under my fingers, and avoid B's gaze across the table. I think we should try talking, maybe somewhere where hurtful things can't be said. Positive dialogue only. Behind the conversation, I can feel the presence of Mum's latest self-help book. It's in the careful use of the passive voice, the measured tone, the positive dialogue and hurtful things. But when it makes me waver, when it makes me want to say, yes, Mum, whatever would make you feel better, I think of the choice my mother helped Carla to make. How she let my sister choose to end treatment, to give up. I'm not sure even the Derren Brown kind of hypnotherapy could help me deal with that. I'll think about it, I say. Goodbye, Mum. Bye, Lena. B watches me across the table, letting me regroup. Okay, she says eventually. B's been on the UpGo project with me for the last year. She's seen me through every day since Carla died. She knows as much about my relationship with my mum as my boyfriend does, if not more. I only get to see Ethan at the weekends and the odd midweek evening if we can both get away from work on time, whereas B and I are together about 16 hours a day. I rub my eyes hard. My hands come away grainy with mascara. I must look an absolute state. You were right. I shouldn't have taken the call. I handled that all wrong. Sounded like you did pretty well to me, B says. Please, talk to me about something else. Something that isn't my family, or work, or anything else similarly disastrous. Tell me about your date last night. If you want non-disastrous, you're going to need to pick another topic, B says, settling back in her chair. Oh no, not good, I ask. I'm blinking back tears, but B kindly ploughs on, pretending not to notice. Nope. Odious. I knew it was a no as soon as he leaned in to kiss me on the cheek, and all I could smell was the foisty, mouldy man towel he must have used to wash his face. That works. It's gross enough to startle me back to the present.
Ew, I say. He had this massive globule of sleepy dust in the corner of his eye too, like eye snot. Oh, B. I'm trying to find the right way to tell her to stop giving up on people so quickly, but my powers of pep-talking seem to have deserted me. And in any case, that towel thing really is quite disgusting. I am on the brink of giving up and facing an eternity as a single mother, B says, trying to catch the waiter's eye. I've come to the decision that dating is genuinely worse than loneliness. At least when you're alone, there's no hope, right? No hope? Yeah, no hope. Lovely. We all know where we stand. Alone, so we entered the world, so shall we leave it, etc., etc. Whereas dating is full of hope. In fact, dating is really one long, painful exercise in discovering how disappointing other humans are. Every time you start to believe you found a good, kind man, she wiggles her fingers, out come the mummy issues and the fragile egos and the weird cheese fetishes. The waiter finally looks our way. The usual, he calls across the cafe. Yup, extra syrup on her pancakes, B calls back, pointing at me. Did you say cheese fetishes, I ask. Let's just say I've seen some photos that have really put me off Brie. Brie, I say, horrified. But, oh God, Brie is so delicious. How could anyone corrupt Brie? B pats my hand. I suspect you'll never have to find out, my friend. In fact, yes, if I'm supposed to be cheering you up, why aren't we talking about your ever-so-perfect love life? Surely the countdown's on for Ethan to pop the question. She catches my expression. No, don't want to talk about that either? I've just got... I flap my hands, eyes pricking again. A big wave of the horror. Oh God, oh God, oh God. Which life crisis are you oh-godding about, just so I know? B asks. Work. I press my knuckles against my eyes until it hurts. I can't believe they're not staffing me for 2 whole months. It's like a mini firing. Actually, B says, and her tone makes me move my hands and open my eyes, it's a 2-month holiday. Yes, but Lena, I love you, and I know you've got a lot of shit going on right now, but please try to see that this could be a good thing, because it's going to be quite hard to continue loving you if you're going to spend the next 8 weeks complaining about getting 2 months paid leave. You could go to Bali, or explore the Amazon rainforest, or sail around the world. She raises her eyebrows. Do you know what I'd give to have that kind of freedom? I swallow. Yes, right. Sorry, B. You're all right. I know this is about more than time off work for you. Just spare a thought for those of us who spend our allotted holiday at dinosaur museums full of 9-year-olds, yeah? I breathe in and out slowly, trying to let that sink in. Thank you, I say, as the waiter approaches our table. I needed to hear that. B smiles at me, then looks down at her plate. You know, she says casually, you could use the time off to get back to our business plan. I wince. B and I have been planning on setting up our own consultancy firm for a couple of years. We were almost ready to go when Carla got sick. Now things have kind of stalled a little. Yes, I say as cheerily as I can manage. Absolutely. B raises an eyebrow. I sag. I'm so sorry, B. I want to, I really do. It just feels impossible now. How are we going to launch our own business when I'm finding it so hard just holding down my job at Cellmount? B chews a mouthful of pancake and looks thoughtful. Okay, she says. Your confidence has taken a hit lately. I get it. I can wait. But even if you don't use this time to work on the business plan, you should use it to work on you. My Lena Cotton doesn't talk about holding down a job like that's the best she can do, and she definitely doesn't use the word impossible. And I want my Lena Cotton back. So, she points her fork at me. You've got 2 months to find her for me. And how am I going to do that? B shrugs. Finding yourself isn't really my forte. I'm just doing strategy here. You're on deliverables. That gets a laugh out of me. Thank you, B, I say suddenly, reaching to clutch her hand. You're so great, really, you're phenomenal. Well, tell that to the single men of London, my friend, she says, giving my hand a pat and then picking up her fork again. Chapter 2. Eileen. It's been 4 lovely long months since my husband made off with the instructor from our dance class, and until this very moment, I haven't missed him once. I stare at the jar on the sideboard with my eyes narrowed. My wrist is still singing with pain from 1/4 of an hour trying to wrench off the lid, but I'm not giving up. Some women live alone all their lives and they eat food out of jars. I give the jar a good glare and myself a good talking to. I am a 79-year-old woman. I have given birth. I have chained myself to a bulldozer to save a forest. I have stood up to Betsy about the new parking rules on Lower Lane.
I can open this wretched jar of pasta sauce. Deck eyes me from the windowsill as I rummage through the drawer of kitchen implements in search of something that'll do the job of my increasingly useless fingers. You think I'm a daft old woman, don't you? I say to the cat. Deck swishes his tail. It's a sardonic swish. All humans are daft, that swish says. You should take a leaf out of my book. I have my jars opened for me. Well, just be grateful your tea for tonight is in a pouch, I tell him, waggling a spaghetti spoon his way. I don't even like cats. It was Wade's idea to get kittens last year, but he lost interest in Ant and Deck when he found Miss Cha-Cha-Cha and decided that Hamley was too small for him, and that only old people keep cats. You can keep them both, he said, with an air of great magnanimity. They suit your lifestyle better. Smug sod. He's older than me anyway, 81 come September. And as for my lifestyle, well, just you wait and see, Wade Cotton. Just you bloody wait and see. Things are going to be changing around here, Declan, I tell the cat, my fingers closing around the bread knife in the back of the drawer. Deck gives a slow, unimpressed blink. Then his eyes widen and he swishes out of the window as I lift the knife with both hands to stab the lid of the jar. I let out a little ha as I pierce it. It takes a few stabs like an amateur murderer in an Agatha Christie play. But this time, when I twist the lid, it turns easily. I hum to myself as I triumphantly empty the contents into the pan. There. Once the sauce is warmed through and the pasta's cooked, I settle back down at the dining room table with my tea and examine my list. Basil Wallingham. Pros. Lives just down the road, not far to walk. Own teeth. Still got enough oomph in him to chase squirrels off bird feeders. Cons. Tremendous bore. Always wearing tweed. Might well be a fascist. Mr. Rogers. Pros. Only 67. Full head of hair. Very impressive. Dances like Pasharoff of Strictly. Even more impressive. Polite to everyone, even Basil. Most impressive of all. Cons. Highly religious man. Very pious. Likely to be dull in bed? Only visits Hamley once a month. Shows no signs of interest in anyone except Jesus. Dr. Piotr Novak. Pros. Polish. How exciting. Doctor. Useful for ailments. Very interesting to talk to and exceptional at Scrabble. Cons. Rather too young for me. 59. Almost certainly still in love with his ex-wife. Looks a bit like Wade. Not his fault, but off-putting. I chew slowly and pick up my pen. I've been ignoring this thought all day, but I really ought to list all the unattached men of the right age. After all, I've put Basil on there, haven't I? Arnold McIntyre. Pros. Lives next door. Appropriate age, 72. Cons. Odious human being. Poisoned my rabbit, as yet unproven, granted, but I know he did. Cut back my tree full of bird's nest, sucks all joy from the world, probably feasts on kittens for breakfast, likely descended from ogres, hates me almost as much as I hate him. I cross out likely descended from ogres after a moment because I ought not to bring his parents into it. They might have been perfectly nice for all I know. But I'm leaving the part about kittens. There, a complete list. I tilt my head, but it looks just as bleak from that angle as it does straight on. I have to face the truth. Pickings are very slim in Hamley and Harksdale, population 168. If I want to find love at this stage of my life, I need to be looking further afield. Over to Tauntingham, for instance. There's at least 200 people in Tauntingham, and it's only 30 minutes on the bus. The telephone rings. I get to the living room just in time. Hello? Grandma, it's Lena. I beam. Hold on, let me get myself sat down. I settle back into my favourite armchair, the green one with the rose pattern. This phone call is the best part of any day. Even when it was bitterly sad, when all we talked about was Carla's death, or anything but that because that felt too painful, even then these calls with Lena kept me going. How are you, love? I ask Lena. I'm fine, how are you? I narrow my eyes. You're not fine. I know, it just came out, sorry. Like when someone sneezes and you say bless you. I hear her swallow. Grandma, I had a panic attack at work. They sent me off on a 2-month sabbatical. Oh, Lena,
I press my hand to my heart. But it's no bad thing that you're getting some time off, I say quickly. A little break from it all will do you good. They're sidelining me. I've been off my game, Grandma. Well, that's understandable, given... No, she says, and her voice catches. It's not. God, I promised Carla. I told her I wouldn't let it hold me back, losing her, and... She always said... She said she was so proud, and now I... She's crying. My hand grips at my cardigan, like Ant or Dex paws when they're sitting in my lap. Even as a child, Lena hardly ever cried. Not like Carla. When Carla was upset, she would throw her arms in the air, the very picture of misery, like a melodramatic actress in a play. It was hard not to laugh. But Lena would just frown and dip her head, looking up at you reproachfully through those long, dark eyelashes. Come on, love. Carla would have wanted you to take holidays, I tell her. I know I should be thinking of it as a holiday, but I can't. It's just... I hate that I messed up. This is muffled, as if she's speaking into her hands. I take off my glasses and rub the bridge of my nose. You didn't mess up, love. You're stressed, that's what it is. Why don't you come up and stay this weekend? Everything looks better over a mug of hot chocolate, and we can talk properly, and you can have a little break from it all up here in Hamley. There's a long silence. You haven't been to visit for an awfully long time, I say tentatively. I know. I'm really sorry, Grandma. Oh, that's all right. You came up when Wade left. I was ever so grateful for that. And I'm very lucky to have a granddaughter who calls me so often. But I know chatting over the phone isn't the same, and it's not that I... You know I really would love to see you. No mention of her mother. Before Carla's death, Lena would have come up to see Marion once a month at least. When will this end, this miserable feud between them? I'm so careful never to mention it. I don't want to interfere, it's not my place. But... Did your mother call you? Another long silence. Yes. About... What was it she'd settled on in the end? Hypertherapy? Hypnotherapy. Ah, yes. Lena says nothing. She's so steely, our Lena. How will the two of them ever get through this when they're both so bloody stubborn? Right. I'll stay out of it, I say into the silence. I'm sorry, Grandma. I know it's hard for you. No, no, don't worry about me. But will you think about coming up here at the weekend? It's hard to help from so far away, love. I hear her sniff. Do you know what, Grandma? I will come. I've been meaning to, and I really would love to see you. There, I beam. It'll be lovely. I'll make you one of your favourites for tea and clue you in on all the village gossip. Roland's on a diet, you know, and Betsy tried to dye her hair, but it went wrong, and I had to drive her to the hairdresser's with a tea towel on her head. Lena snorts with laughter. Thanks, Grandma, she says after a moment. You always know how to make me feel better. That's what Eileen's do, I say. They look after each other. I used to say that to her as a child. Lena's full name is Eileen, too. Marion named her after me when we all thought I was dying after a bad bout of pneumonia back in the early 90s. When we realised I wasn't at death's door after all, it got very confusing, and so Lena became Lena. Love you, Grandma, she says. You too, love. After she hangs up the telephone, I realise I've not told her about my new project. I wince. I promised myself I would tell her the next time she called. It's not that I'm embarrassed to be looking for love exactly, but young people tend to find old people wanting to fall in love rather funny. Not unkindly, just without thinking. The way you laugh at children behaving like grown-ups or husbands trying to do the weekly shop. I make my way back to the dining room, and when I get there, I look down at my sad little list of eligible Hamley men. It all feels rather small now. My thoughts are full of Carla. I try to think of other things, Basil's tweed jackets, Piotr's ex-wife, but it's no use, so I settle down and let myself remember. I think of Carla as a little girl with a mass of curls and scuffed knees, clutching her sister's hand. I think of her as the young woman in a washed-out Greenpeace t-shirt, too thin but grinning, full of fire. And then I think of the Carla who lay in Marion's front room, gaunt and drawn and fighting the cancer with all she had left. I shouldn't paint her that way as if she looked weak. She was still so Carla, still fiery. Even on Lena's last visit, just days before she died, Carla would take no nonsense from her big sister. She was in her special hospital bed,
brought into Marion's living room one evening by a group of gentle NHS staff, who put it up with astonishing efficiency and cleared out before I could even make them so much as a cup of tea. Marion and I were standing in the doorway. Lena was beside the bed, in the armchair we'd moved there once and never shifted back. The living room didn't centre around the television anymore, but around that bed, with its magnolia cream bars on each side of the mattress, and that grey remote control always lost under the blankets for adjusting the bed's height and shifting Carla when she wanted to sit up. "You're incredible," Lena was telling her sister, her eyes bright with tears. "I think you're incredible and so brave and..." Carla reached out, faster than I'd thought she could now, and poked her sister in the arm. "Stop it. You'd never say that sort of thing if I wasn't dying," she said. Even with her voice thin and dry, you could hear the humour. "You're way nicer to me these days. It's weird. I miss you telling me off for wasting my life away." Lena winced. "I didn't..." "Lena, it's fine. I'm teasing." Lena shifted uncomfortably in the armchair, and Carla raised her eyes upwards as if to say, "Oh, for heaven's sake." I'd grown used to her face without eyebrows by then, because I remember how strange it had looked at first. Stranger, in some ways, than the loss of her long brown curls. "Fine, fine. I'll be serious," she said. She glanced at me and Marion, and then reached for Lena's hand, her fingers too pale against Lena's tanned skin. "All right, serious face on." Carla closed her eyes for a moment. "There is some stuff I wanted to say, you know. Serious stuff." She opened her eyes then, fixing her gaze on Lena. "You remember when we went camping together that summer and you were back from uni and you told me how you thought management consultancy was the way to change the world and I laughed. And then we argued about capitalism." "I remember," Lena said. "I shouldn't have laughed." Carla swallowed. Pain touched her features, a tightening around the eyes, a quiver of her dry lips. "I should have listened and told you I was proud. You're shaping the world, in a way. You're making it better, and the world needs people like you. I want you to kick out all the stuffy old men, and I want you to run the show, launch that business, help people, and promise me you won't let losing me hold you back." Lena was crying then, her shoulders hunched and shaking. Carla shook her head. "Lena, stop it, would you? Jesus, this is what comes of being serious. Do I have to poke you again?" "No," Lena said, laughing through her tears. "No, please don't. It actually kind of hurt." "Well, just know that any time you let an opportunity slip, any time you wonder if you can really do it, any time you think about giving up on anything that you want, I'll be poking you from the afterlife." And that was Carla Cotton for you. She was fierce and she was silly, and she knew we couldn't manage without her. The Switch and my next novel, The Road Trip, are available to pre-order now.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this programme.